The Joint House and Senate Subcommittee on Claims will come to order. It is Tuesday, March 26th, around 7:12 p.m. And just for people to get to know one another, maybe we should just do an introduction, and we'll start on our left, let the House have their due, and we'll move it on down and bring it back to the chair.
Dwayne Quam, Byron.
Mary Murphy. Herman Howe. Two Harbors, Proctor. Rice Lake Cities.
Jerry Ralph, St. Cloud, Wade Park, St. Augusta, Haven, and Minden Townships.
Jim Carlson, Burnsville and Egan, and I'm not a lawyer.
I'm not.
Jason Keenley, and I am a lawyer from the Office of the Revisor of Statutes.
And Senator Bruce Anderson, Senate District 29, represent a great portion of Wright County and a little smidgen of Rockford City just in Hennepin County. And so glad that everybody could make it. Hope you had fun reading your assignment. My eyes need toothpicks right now to keep them up, but I'll make it. Welcome to the committee and to the audience that's here. I appreciate you all being here. And we're going to start this with a motion. Senator Quam, Representative Murphy, would you give us a motion regarding the minutes from our last hearing?
I move that it be adopted as printed.
Senator Murphy moves that the minutes from the March 27th, 2018, 2018 session of the Claims Committee be adopted. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved as read. And with that, we'll start with a summary. Mr. Keenley, I'd like to have you read the summary on our agenda, item number 3 of the claims that are before us.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. I will read a couple of quick summaries of claims that have been either dismissed for lack of jurisdiction or held over for procedural reasons. I'll pause after each one to give members if they have any comment before I start into the next summary. So for claims dismissed for lack of jurisdiction, there was a claim brought against the Metropolitan Council that was filed by Tim and Sheila Dawoski. Minnesota Statute Section 473.123 Subdivision 1 created the Metropolitan Council as a public corporation and political subdivision of the state. Minnesota Statute Section 15.082 states, notwithstanding any other law, the state is not liable for obligations of a public corporation created by statute. Under that section, the state is not liable for any action of the Metropolitan Council, and because the Joint Subcommittee on Claims hears claims against the state, and the state is statutorily prohibited from liability for the actions of the Metropolitan Council, the subcommittee does not have jurisdiction.
Are there any comments from the members regarding what Mr. Keenley just read pertaining to the Met Council? Any comments? Okay. Senator, Mr. Keenley, would you please continue?
On to claims that are being held over for procedural reasons. In October 2016, Wright and Becker County submitted a claim for reimbursement of attorney's fees for litigation in Otto versus Wright and Becker Counties. At the time of the last two subcommittee hearings, the litigation was still ongoing. Senate File 154 and House File 187 were introduced this year. They also provide reimbursement for these costs. The new state auditor has testified in favor of the bills moving through committee, and the bills have received bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate. Because of the potential resolution of this claim by other legislative means, this claim is being held over.
Members, any comments to the Wright-Becker claim that was submitted and is now held over in committee? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in committee, the new AG, when asked if this is something that the AG would do, protect the constitutionality so that local government didn't have to shoulder the burden, he said that he felt that was part of the duty for, you know, so that sort of reinforces the state taking care of it through the legislation.
Very good. Any other comments for the claim on the Wright and Becker County's claim that's now in committee? I see that we have a gentleman from the County Association, Mr. Hilgert. If you could just come, just give us a brief comment on what your thoughts are. Appreciate that, and identify yourself for the tape. And
sure. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Matt Hilgert. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties, and this is my first time in front of the Claims Division, so excited to be here, and thank you for the time. AMC stands in support of reimbursing these counties for the legal fees associated with the defense of this law. Just as a very quick history brief, and I know Senator Carlson was even on the committee where this did get put into an omnibus bill, but this started back in 2015. As you may know, all local governments are required to do an annual audit. Some local governments were treated differently than others. Cities, for the most part, have been allowed to have private audits for their annual audits. So back in 2015, counties asked for that same privilege. We were granted it by the legislature in a bipartisan vote. That law was appealed to the district courts by then-Auditor Otto. The district courts ruled in favor of the counties. It proceeded up to the Court of Appeals, also ruled in favor of the counties, and then it went to the Supreme Court. In that time, and it should be known that Auditor then Otto, sued three counties, not all 87 counties. She sued Ramsey, Becker, and Wright. And those three counties had to bear the costs for this lawsuit. We were, at first, we thought that perhaps the state would intervene. They did not. So the taxpayers of those three local governments had to defend the entire case throughout the 2.5 years that it took to get a decision. While the costs might seem nominal, they are still costs. And for some of the counties, especially the smaller two counties, they represent a larger portion of their levies and budgets. The one thing that I just wanted to point out is that this the claim in front of you right now does not include Ramsey County. You may want to add that in potentially. And then I also had just a question on procedure. This bill has been introduced in prior sessions, and it has not been funded. It was part of the omnibus bill last year that got a gubernatorial veto. So I guess the question is, if it isn't funded, does the claims committee does meet after session? Is there opportunities for these claims to be funded after that?
Mr. Hilgert, we will meet at least twice a year, if not, if there's something else that comes up that Mr. Keenly and his staff, because they receive the claims for our committee, if there's something that comes up that needs an urgent meeting of the claims committee. So what will happen with our claim, we'll hang on to it here in committee until after session, hoping that the results of session will produce a favorable result towards Wright and Becker. And if not, then it will still be in our claims committee to be heard at a later date and time whenever we decide, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just end by saying, you know, counties are looking forward to moving on from this episode. And it's been a long 3 years. However, we're really happy about the outreach that the new auditor's office has had with some of these counties. They have reached out specifically to these counties to talk with them. And so we're looking forward to turning a new page. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. Thank you for being here. And with that, the claim for Wright and Becker will be held over in our committee until later notice.
Moving on to claims held over in the Department of Corrections, there's a claimant, James, sought compensation for lost shoes. The department is still working on finding records relating to the number of shoes claimant had in his inventory at the time. Also, DOC, the Department of Corrections, claimant O'Reilly filed a claim for injuries relating to damage suffered to his finger when it was smashed between carts. At last year's hearing, not enough time had passed to determine if the claimant had reached maximum medical improvement. Since the last hearing, the claimant has been released. The Department of Corrections has attempted to contact him to inform him of the need for an independent medical examination, but they had so far been unsuccessful.
Any comments on that last two claims that were being held over from last time? Senator Ralph?
Mr. Chair, on these claims, is there a period of lapse after which, in other words, if Mr. O'Reilly fails to contact the Department of Corrections or whoever it is he's supposed to get in touch with, is there some statutory dismissal after a certain period of time?
Senator Ralph, I would defer to Mr. Keenly or either the Department of Corrections, too, if they have a stand on that. I'm not sure. It could be held over again, I guess.
Yeah, Chair Anderson, Senator Ralph. There's nothing statutorily that says we have to. At some point in the past when we've been unable to follow up for multiple years, the subcommittee has entertained a motion to dismiss for trying to reach out for X number of years. Typically, we try to at least give them more than 1 year, but certainly after so many years.
Any other comments? Mr. Keeley?
The last claims to be held over this year have to deal with the claims that we heard last year dealing with Mille Lacs. Last year, 13 claims were filed against the Department of Natural Resources claiming lost revenue. The claimants testified to the economic conditions in the area and their personal stories of how the walleye fishing restrictions have affected their businesses. At the end of the claims hearing, the claims related to Mille Lacs were held over. Members of the subcommittee spoke that the claims subcommittee may not be the proper venue for the aid that the legislature may want to pursue regarding Mille Lacs. At the time, there was a broader legislative remedy being pursued by Representative Erickson in House File 3240. As mentioned in last year's hearing, the subcommittee has limited jurisdiction and can only hear claims specifically brought to the subcommittee. Other potential legislative remedies can extend beyond the limited scope of the claims subcommittee. Senate File 2608 and House File 2659 have been introduced in the legislature this year. This is an updated version of the same bill that Representative Erickson carried last year. Like the Wright and Becker County claims, because of the potential resolution of this claim by other legislative means, these claims are being held over. The subcommittee has received one new related claim that is on the agenda to be heard at this year's subcommittee hearing, and that's the next thing on the agenda.
Well, members, are there any comments or concerns about the claims on Blacks Lake being held over? Any comments? Thoughts? Ideas?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Quam?
I think at this time... Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's good.
I think at this time it appears that there may be a legislative solution. I'm assuming we can hear Mr. Felagy's claim, but I think that at that point we would want to hold it over pending the resolution by the legislature. It sounds like they're trying to come up with a pretty robust program for grant relief to the people, not just to the claimants, but to the businesses surrounding Mille Lacs. And I think that's probably an appropriate and fair way to approach this. So I'm certain we'd want to hear Mr. Felagy's claim, but I think that I would be in favor of laying it over along with the other claims.
Okay. Any other comments? Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the past, this committee had looked at doing something for the claims in the legislative process. The Ways and Means Chair and Committee and other leadership in the House felt that the best way to address it was with a legislative normal process solution and not creating a possible precedence. And that was pursued, and it appears as if we may have that resolution, and that would probably be the best for this committee, because our decisions here do also have to pass through the legislative process. So I concur with the council's recommendation.
Okay. Any other comments on the Mille Lacs Lake claims that were held over from last year? Maybe we should go ahead, and since these claims are already held over in our committee, maybe we should hear the other claim from Mille Lacs Lake, Mr. Felagy, and then we can basically combine all of them together. So if Mr. Steve Felagy would come forward to the hearing table and present, give us your name, Mr. Felagy, for the record, and proceed with your testimony regarding your claim to our committee. Thank you. Welcome.
My name is Steve Felagy. I've been a fishing guide up on Mille Lacs for over 50 years. And I appreciate you guys offering me some time here and working overtime, obviously. I've been a proponent and a cheerleader of our Minnesota DNR for as many years as I go back into the fishing industry. That said, and by the way, I overheard what obviously you guys are talking about, so carrying my case into the legislative session or whatever, that I appreciate anything that that process takes place. The DNR has been put in a bad position. I don't want to get into the, you know, the too much of the nitty-gritty here, the messy part, but the reality of it is that all of the mess that's been going on in Mille Lacs for the last 20 years, and especially the last 3 years where all these claims have come from, has been based on the DNR agreeing to manage Mille Lacs exclusively to accommodate the treaty agreement that the federal courts allowed. And the DNR's own people predicted the position we'd be in today when this all started. The fault that I have with the DNR isn't how they physically manage the lake so much as the fact that they haven't stood up and said, hey, this doesn't work. We can't do our jobs. We're not managing the lake via science and biology, sound science and biology. They haven't stood up and said that. And yet off the record, they all say it. They all agree that it's been a disaster, that they're put in this bad position. They've actually come out and publicly said that if we do buck this, we'll lose our jobs. Don Pereira said that publicly, the fisheries manager, head of fisheries in Minnesota. So I think that these claims and my claim is based on the fact that the DNR has mismanaged Mille Lacs to the point where it got to the last 3 years. I actually believe that they've done a pretty good job the last 3 years because it is to the point or was to the point of needing some strict, more restrictive rules. But what got us here is the problem. And it was predictable, and it was all based on a political thing. There's been a lot of people misinformed about the fact that, well, okay, the federal courts ruled that all of this had to take place, and our hands are tied here in Minnesota. DNR can't do anything differently. Well, the bottom line is that that's not true at all. The federal courts ruled and affirmed treaty rights, but they didn't rule or say anything in regard to how and when those treaty rights would be exercised. And that's what's got our DNR into a bad position, because the DNR, for some reason, in 1998 agreed, as the courts ordered them to go back. The courts ordered the state of Minnesota, DNR, and the tribal side to go back to Minnesota and come to an agreement on how this natural resource should be managed. And they said basically that the tribal side is above state regulation as long as they exercise these treaty rights above state regulation at acceptable levels of conservation, public safety, and public health. In the history of the DNR, in over 100 years, the philosophy has been to protect spawning walleyes, for example. To this day, the DNR every spring closes certain fisheries in Minnesota because they need to protect congregated vulnerable spawning walleyes. And yet, the DNR has been, for some reason, saying that Mille Lacs walleyes don't fit that criteria, even though we've got videos, thousands of minutes of videos of walleyes being taken during the spawn, a foot apart. I mean, I don't know what congregated and vulnerable means, but I mean, when they're a foot apart or 18 inches apart, I mean, what's the definition? But anyway, I think that to make this short and whatever is I think that these claims are legitimate in regard to the DNR mismanaging the lake to get it to the point we are now. And the mismanagement was forced on them in a sense based on these federal, treaty rights. And the mistake that the DNR made and the biggest mismanagement thing that the DNR did was not stand up. The biologists won't stand up and say, hey, this isn't working. Even though their own people in 2002 wrote publicly, Dick Sternberg, just had retired from the Minnesota DNR, one of their head biologists, said that, hey, you can't operate this way. The lake will crash in 10 to 12 years. Well, he was almost within a year. 2012 was when it hit its low point. So
Mr. Felogy, your claim is for $24,000?
Yeah, I mean it's a nominal amount relatively speaking to compared to other claims and whatever. I'm a fishing guide that in later years here have cut back a little bit too on my own. And evidently what happens is that people that hire a guide want to not only catch walleyes, but eat some of what they caught. I offered them, as a matter of fact, I didn't make this claim, and actually I didn't take advantage of that loan program that the state offered here recently, two or three years ago, which hindsight being 2020, we should have done. I was confident in myself that I could turn this thing around. We publicized the fact that we would guarantee, even during a catch and release year, guarantee our customers a limit of walleyes to take home to eat. We purchased walleyes from Lake Winnipeg, commercially packaged, frozen. Before we left the dock, we had a guaranteed limit in the boat. That's what we were advertising. Dennis Anderson, the Star Tribune, did a half-a-page article about it. You couldn't have advertised it better. And yet we got four calls total. So it's obvious that people wanted to keep their own fish and eat walleye, eat their own fish. It's a tradition, it's a cultural thing, whatever you want to call it. And so we went from having a clientele that was endless after 50 years, we've got a pretty good reputation up on Mille Lacs, to a point where, I mean, I did probably four or five trips all last year. I've attempted to, I'm not a genius when it comes to electronic advertising. I mean, I've got a Facebook page, that kind of stuff and whatever. We've had a word of mouth conversation, a clientele for 50 plus years. And I just feel like it's time to somehow expose this silence that the DNR has been evidently ordered or whatever to keep on the record. Anyways, all the biologists off the record would tell us that they agree. But Tom Heinrich, who's a friend of mine, who manages Mille Lacs now, he's down from Lake of the Woods. He and I will sit and have coffee for two or three hours at a time, and he'll say, hey, our hands are tied. Well, you're not tied. The courts invited the state of Minnesota back to court if this isn't working, in plain English. And how can this not be a conservation issue when you've got the biggest walleye jewel in the country to the point where you can't even legally take a walleye or harvest a walleye out of the lake, and that's not a conservation issue to bring back to court? Anyway,
thank you.
I appreciate your time. I don't know what the process is here.
We're going to have some other people come up and testify on your. If there's anybody else that wants to speak, I know that probably Mr. Meyer would like to have a few words regarding that, and then we'll have the members talk about it and ask questions for either you or for other testifiers. So, don't go far.
I won't. Thank you,
Mr. Meyer. Welcome to committee and state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, and thank you for allowing me to be here today. First and foremost, as I testified last year on these claims, the department is very sympathetic of the economic impacts of our operations, management operations on Lake Mille Lacs. We're doing everything we can to restore the lake to a harvestable level. In fact, this coming fishing season, from the opener till the end of May, the harvest, there will be a one-fish limit, one fish per person per day, 21 to 23 inches, over or one over 28. So we're allowing some catch, just the same catch that we've allowed during the ice fishing season the past couple years. So we are getting to a harvestable level of the fish, and we're very excited about that. You have in front of you or in your packets our claim response here, and just a couple really quick things. I know you have a full agenda tonight. The department's hands aren't tied. You know, in Mille Lacs Band of Chippewa versus Minnesota, the United States Supreme Court upheld that the Minnesota Chippewa tribe had valid and enforceable treaty rights to harvest fish across the ceded territory in 1837, including Mille Lacs Lake. This litigation ultimately resulted in a federal consent decree entered by the United States District Court for the District of Minnesota, and as a result, the fisheries harvest on Lake Mille Lacs is subject to extensive regulation and control to accommodate the harvest of both Chippewa bands and state anglers. So each year we sit down with the bands and the tribal fisheries biologists and set a harvestable surplus for walleye in the state in the Lake Mille Lacs. So we are bound by a federal court decree to manage the lake in this way. Obviously, we could appeal that. However, we're very concerned that by going back to court, we may lose, we would probably lose based upon the decision that was made, and we could enter into a 50-50 management, co-management of the lake. Right now, we share the harvestable surplus with the bands, but it's not 50-50. The state gets more fish than the bands do. Briefly, Mr. Chairman and members, the state has a duty to regulate fisheries under the state constitution and federal court orders. The legislature has explicitly directed that the commissioner do all things necessary to preserve, protect, and propagate desired fish species and ensure recreational opportunities for all anglers. Also, the evidence shows that the aquatic system at Mille Lacs Lake is undergoing significant change, as many of the lakes are in this region. The water clarity is increasing. It's increased 1.5 times since the mid-90s. So you can see down 1.5 times farther now than you could in the 1990s, which changes the walleye. Walleye like dark water. They prefer deep water sometimes. The sunlight throws them off. It's hard to catch fish in the day. And the walleye productivity is decreasing region-wide. I have articles I can share with the committee that talks about walleye pressure, walleye reproductivity in Wisconsin. Overall, the entire state is down 27% due to biological considerations. Lastly, Mr. Chairman, as we discussed last year in the committee, just about the legislative claims being the proper venue for this process, and we do agree with the committee and support that decision that the subcommittee noted last year, that such claims were more appropriately addressed through the regular legislative process aimed at policy initiatives, economic development for the affected community, rather than selective aid to a handful of individuals presenting claims before you. Mr. Chairman, the rest of our response I know you have in your packet, and as I said, I know you have a long agenda. Those are just some of the brief points that I'd like to raise, and we do support House File 2659, Senate File 2608 to provide a legislative remedy to this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to testify on behalf of the claim here for Mr. Felagy? If not, members, do we have any questions? Senator Ralph.
Thank you. I just, Mr. Felagy, this is really not a question, but more of a comment. I have to let the committee members know that we're looking at a legend here. As most of you probably know, I owned a company called Lake Master, and one of the monuments to the fishing industry on Mille Lacs was the way we named the structures on the maps that we produced, and one of those is known as Felagy's Needle, and it's a piece of structure on the lake. And I would like to ask Mr. Felagy, what's the origin of that name? How did that come about?
Mr. Felagy.
Of the needle?
Yes.
Well, my dad, you know, we didn't have GPS, obviously, when we found those spots. You know, we named most of the mudflats on Mille Lacs, let alone Felagy's Needle. But, you know, we followed edges of bars and had a vision, mental vision of how wide they were or how the shape they were. And when we finally, my dad finally got to the south end of the backer flat, all of a sudden he was one boat width from one side to the other, and it was a couple hundred yards long, and I don't know, out of the clear blue, he probably said, "Boy, that's like a needle," and it stuck, you know. We were the first human beings to fish the backer flat, for example, and most of those flats. And the story behind, I don't want to get into this too long here, but there's the history behind finding the backer flat, by the way, is kind of interesting, which is part of the needle. I was a little guy in 1963. I was 8, 9 years old, and in the evenings we'd fish bullheads off of the dock or off of my dad's launch that was parked in our harbor. And a bullhead would swallow the hook once in a while, and I'd have to get a pliers out. Well, one particular evening, the pliers got set next to the compass on my dad's launch, and the next morning, his compass was locked in place, and he didn't know it because of that metal pliers there, and he got all screwed up on the direction he was going, and it was foggy and stuff, and so they literally were lost out in the middle of the lake, and as far as where they were structurally, not lost, but so they put some sinkers down and went trolling in a direction and found a bump and came up on it, and the walleyes were there, and a family by the name of Backer, Cal Backer, who owned a bar in Minneapolis or New Ulm at the time, was on the boat, and we typically named a lot of those flats after people that were on our boats, and so the Backer flat was found because of one of the little fellas, he's putting the pliers next to the compass, and eventually we worked our way down to the needle, so that's the history there. But anyway.
Representative Qualm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd move to table the Mille Lacs claims to allow additional legislative time this year.
Representative Qualm moves that we table the Felogy claim along with the other claims until our next hearing. Is that your hearing?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. That would allow for the progression of the legislative action that we discussed earlier.
The motion Senate Representative Qualm is making is that we move to table this bill, the Felogy claim from Mille Lacs Lake, along with the other claims from Mille Lacs Lake that were basically on hold until a future claims committee hearing. Any comments? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. The claim is laid over until a future time when we take them up again. Thank you.
Appreciate your time.
The next item on our agenda are claims against the Department of Human Services. Mr. Stephen Steck, I don't know if I've got that word right. I'm sure I'll get corrected, but that's welcome to committee, and identify yourself by the tape and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and honorable members of the committee, and that was actually very close. It was Stephen Stasek. I'm the the DCT claim specialist. That's my role, and I guess if it's permissible, I'd like to start addressing the claim with Mr. Zimmer.
Yes.
Okay. I guess the question, that was put to the committee today was whether it was reasonable that Mr. Zimmer had an expectation to believe that his keyboard would be reviewed specifically for its size. And I would put to the committee that before you kind of get into that the question first starting off was, would Mr. Zimmer have a reasonable expectation to believe that his keyboard would have been reviewed at all? And I would first start off saying yes. And some of the reasons why, being that MSLP clients, not just Mr. Zimmer, are expected to be familiar with the policies and procedures. So that being said, you have to ask yourself, well, did Mr. Zimmer have the opportunity to view the policies? Did he have the time? Did he have the capability to do so? Mr. Zimmer has been at the MSOP since approximately 2015. And so he's had at least the time to be able to review the policies. And whether he actually could access them, he obviously has submitted them to this committee as evidence to support his claim. Now, that being said, specifically, a lot of the times he's been citing the property policy, and that's what I'd like to delve into. And kind of giving a general overview of how items, whether it be keyboards, whether it be clothing, whether it be food, anything that comes into the facility, how it's processed. And that's governed by the property policy. So when something comes in, whether it is through the mail, whether it's on a visit, anything like that, eventually it's going to be routed to the special services. And what they do is they open it up. They want to make sure that they're what's inside the package. And the actual policy cites that special service is subdivision A4. Special services staff open, inspect, and search any items received, ordered into the facility for contraband. So contraband, that in and of itself, is something that's prohibited. But I digress. What they're going to do is they're going to open up the package, and they're going to see what it is. So they have the contraband policy. They're going to check to make sure that it's contraband or prohibited. So an example of a contraband item would be obviously like a weapon, something like drugs, something that is not allowed within the secure perimeter. Now, if it's not something like that, what they're going to do is they're going to take a look at the property list, which gives a general overview for items that the clients that are allowed to have. Not so much as outwardly permitted, but it's something that they know that they can have within the facility. So first off, they're going to see, and then they're going to take a look at the list, and they're going to see, okay, well, is this particular item allowed? And if it is, then they're going to move on, and they're going to see, okay, well, is there any limitations? Is it there a limitation on, for example, quantity of what they're allowed to have? Is there a limitation due to, for example, size? Is there a limitation due to the area that they live in? And they're going to compare it to that. Now, if it is permitted outwardly through the policy, they're going to obviously give it to the client. But if it starts delving into the question of when they take a look at it, is it on that list, but could it be possibly contraband under a different policy, or is it appropriate to have within the facility? And that's when it goes into the idea of being questionable. And questionable under this particular policy is an item neither clearly allowed or defined as contraband upon initial review by staff. So, that being said, if, for example, they find it questionable, special services staff, per the policy, they can route that particular item for further review, inspection, or approval. And one of the items or one of the areas that they can do that is the allowable items committee, which in this case is where Mr. Zimmer's keyboard eventually got routed. So that being said, I think when it comes down to, and I wanted to paint a little bit of a picture, whether or not it goes back to, again, the question of whether Mr. Zimmer had a reasonable expectation to believe that his keyboard would be reviewed for size. If you take a look at the dimensions of what Mr. Zimmer gave as the size of his keyboard, was that it was 52 inches long, which is approximately 4 feet, so give or take a few inches. It was like 16, I think it was 0.67 inches, which is about a foot and a half wide, give or take a few inches, and it's 37 and a half pounds. So that's a considerable size, considering also that you have to see where Mr. Zimmer is going to be storing it, because Mr. Zimmer is only permitted to store his property within his room. Now, Mr. Zimmer resides at the MSOP St. Peter campus, and particularly the area or the building that he resides in, the approximate dimensions of that room is 140 square feet, and that's a dual occupancy room. So that means in that room, there are two people living there, meaning there are going to be two beds, There's going to be two desks. There's going to be two areas to store their clothing. There's also going to be a room divider, and there's also going to be a sink and a toilet. So on top of whatever property that Mr. Zimmer is already having within his room. So I guess the question, if you put things into perspective in that regard, is Mr. Zimmer, knowing that his keyboard was going to be that large, knowing that he's going to have to store it in his room, which is a limited size, would it be reasonable to expect that that through that process of the keyboard coming in, staff looking at it and going, well, yes, it is permitted by that particular policy. It's obviously not contraband, but there may be something else that may not be appropriate about that item. So, and that's obviously going to be the question that I put to the committee today. So,
thank you, Mr. Stesic. Is it Stesic?
Stesic, sir.
Stesic?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Members, questions for the testifier. Senator Ralph.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stesic, the one, just a thought here. As I look at the property list, it appears that keyboards are permitted.
Yes, that is correct, sir.
And most keyboards are pretty good-sized pieces of merchandise, if I remember keyboards that I've seen.
Yes, Mr. Chair. That is true. However, there are keyboards that they come in different sizes. Mm-hmm. They can, I believe, also what Mr. Zimmer sent in was a 77, I believe it was a 77 or 76 key keyboard. They also make keyboards much smaller than that, I believe, mm-hmm. depending like a 3-octave or 4-octave keyboard. I believe a full 88 is I believe 8 octaves. So, sorry. Yes, sir.
Follow up.
So, Mr. Chair, I guess the question I have, you said reasonable expectations. Apparently, there were other keyboards of fairly similar size, according to the test or the information provided by Mr. Zimmer, that it seems to me would have led him to believe that as long as this was not going to be a grand piano, that he had the reasonable expectation that it would be allowed in. And it seems that there is no listing in the property list of a maximum size, so that would leave him with a very little opportunity to make a judgment before, in other words, he would have to spend the money on the shipping and hope that it didn't get denied. And I guess my question to you is it unreasonable that someone expect that I'm allowed a keyboard, this is within the general range of keyboards that I've seen, that he would then not be able to have that just because it was, and I don't know how much bigger than the other keyboards, but apparently from the filling out of the claim, it looks like that there might be a legitimate reason that he would have believed that this keyboard would be allowed. I mean, can you comment on that?
Mr. Stesic.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much. I am not familiar in what keyboards are actually within the facility. I know that they are assessed on an individual basis in the sense that because there is no size limit, what they do is they take a look at things on an individual basis. And again, not just because it's on that property list, and I'll, even though it's about a keyboard, I'll give an example of something that perhaps is on that list that it meets the criteria that perhaps other people have, but given there's something else about that particular item that would make it not permittable. And that, first off, is like a TV. Now, under the policy, it says that a TV need to be a flat screen, it needs to be 24 inches at a maximum. However, when staff have it come in, there might be a functionality of that about that television that might make it questionable. That might, for example, does it have internet access? Does it have a port on it that that might make it in and of itself contraband? However, That being said, in regards to Mr. Zimmer's keyboard, Mr. Zimmer could have also contacted the Allowable Items Committee, which often frequently makes these determinations and provided some insight saying, I have, obviously, he gave some research to this. He said, I want to purchase this particular individual item. He had the opportunity to contact the Allowable Items Committee and say, I want to order a keyboard. Here's the dimensions. Here's the size. Would there be an issue with this? But it's from my knowledge that Mr. Zimmer did not.
Senator Ralph, any further questions?
Just to follow up, it said in his claim that he submitted measurements of a keyboard currently in the facility that is 1 inch shorter than the one he purchased, and another that is the same depth and height. Now, I don't know who he submitted those to, but it sounds like he did try to take some sort of steps to determine whether this item would be contraband or not. Can you enlarge on that, or do you have information on that?
Mr. Cecik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. To my knowledge, I do not know. I did ask the special services supervisor if any questions or regards, because that individual does sit on the Allowable Items Committee, if anybody had submitted anything in regards to like a size or anything like that, and he was not familiar with anything of that nature. Now, as to whether or not there is actually a keyboard within the facility that is 1 inch shorter or similar in nature, I do not know. I know that Mr. Zimmer cited, I believe in his response or part of his claim, that the identical keyboard is within the facility, and I may be incorrect in that, but I thought I remember seeing it, that is something that the facility has, and that's available for everyone. And that's the idea of that being stored within that particular room it was the issue.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move to deny the claim.
Representative Quam moves to deny the claim for the Beau Jacob Zimmer claim before us. Any further comments to that motion? All those in favor of denying the claim for Mr. Beau Jacob Zimmer signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign.
Aye.
The motion has been passed. The claim has been denied. Mr. Keenley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. The other claim regarding MSOP I marked recommended for denial. If we want to take that up as well, or if people want to. It's in the denial binder.
Oh, it's in there. Sorry. Members, if you would like to take out the Sean Jameson claim, it's in the denial in your thick binder. I guess, Mr. Cecik, you could come back to the table to talk to us. It should be right on the top of the first claim in the big, thick binder. Mr. Cecik, regarding the Sean Jameson claim.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Regarding Mr. Jameson's claim, Mr. Jameson claimed a multitude of items that he alleged that were missing or were not in his items that were secured when he made it his initial. I believe it was initially secured on, I believe it was the 11th. And subsequently is when he went to the high security area. Now, through my investigation of this particular claim, I couldn't establish at any point that Mr. Jameson was actually in possession of any of the items that he claimed. And essentially, MSOP couldn't lose what they never had possession in the first place. And the issues specifically stood out to me was that he was in a single room occupied only by himself. So that if those items would have been perhaps left or, left out or been in his property at some point within that particular room, because as part of the policy when a client has to be taken to the high security area, all the client's items need to be packed up. A lot of the times it will be whatever's in his bins. And then any loose items such as durable goods are written down on what they call a notice and receipt of secured items. So everything up to a certain point is inventoried. And they usually will zip tie those bins closed. So it gives, and those zip ties have numbers on them so that it gives, I'd say it's like a tracking, if that makes sense, so that it's much easier to be able to say, okay, these items were within the bins, these bins were opened, these zip ties were removed, and this is what the contents were. They were closed back up again. New zip ties were put on. So there's a chain of custody a little bit more than just, okay, here's his property. So throughout his going from unit to unit to unit, and it kind of touches again on the property policy, that certain items aren't permitted to be within certain units. And where Mr. Jameson went after he was done in his... Sorry, when Mr. Jameson was done in the high security area, he went to a unit called Omega 3. Omega 3 has certain limitations on items that they can have, and many of them being because it's not permitted to have like a DVD player or a Blu-ray player or anything that would play movies. Movies are not permitted, as equally are game stations. They're not permitted on that unit. So if they would have been secured, because at that point, all Mr. Jameson's property was brought to him, and he had to get into what they call property compliance. Compliance meaning that anything that is allowed within on that particular unit, he's allowed to have. Anything that's not allowed, what they will do is they will, again, mark it down on a notice and receipt of secure items so it's thoroughly documented of all the property items that he had in his possession or that was secured as part of his initial placements. And at any point, were the items that he's alleging that he lost, were they ever documented? So I couldn't establish whether or not they were ever in his property in the first place.
Thank you, Mr. Stisek. Representative Murphy.
I move we deny.
The motion on the floor right now is that Representative Murphy moved to deny the claim for Sean Jameson. Any questions or comments to that? All those in favor of denying the claim for Mr. Sean Jameson signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. The motion has been adopted and the Sean Jameson claim has been denied. Members, while we got the property claims out here, are there any claims within the property claims? That would be on the second sheet that we have. Are there any claims that you would like to have held out or talked about later on? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe the ones that are indicated in red.
Okay.
We should at least review and do a discussion. And I would move that the items not in red, that we accept the recommendations of staff on those claims.
Anybody else have any further comments or any other claims that under property claims that you would like to have held out other than the red ones? I have a question on the Mr. Number 35 and 36, Mr. William Linear. I'd like to have those held out, those two claims. I also would like to have the first claim held out, Ms. Enriquez. Any other claims you might have that of the property claims that you would like to see held out and discussed? Okay, the claims right now, property claims, Senator Representative Quam has moved that we deny all claims except for the ones that have been discussed, number 1, number 21, number 23, number 30, number 35 and 36, and number 58.
Does that sound reasonable? All those in favor of denying those claims except the ones that were read off, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. The motion has been carried that we deny all claims except for number 1, number 21, number 23, number 30, number 35 and 36, and number 58, basically those that were labeled on the list as being in red. We will now go back to the front page again to take up the claims, medical reimbursement claims, disbursement to the Department of Corrections for injury claims. And Ms. Whitney, I see you're at the table already. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the committee and for the tape and proceed with your testimony, that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jean Whitney. I'm Associate General Counsel for the Department of Corrections, and I'm happy to be here and answer your questions.
Mr. Chair, could she speak more into the microphone more closely? Thank you.
Just pull that right up to your mouth there, if you can.
Now it's on?
Yes, it's okay. On. Yeah. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, the claims that are in, that we've submitted for medical reimbursement are the claims that we have paid to people who were performing community work service in the community and they had injuries. We paid their medical bills, and we submitted with this claim all the documents that show the bills that we paid at medical assistance rates as are required by the statute. And the total for this year was $5,889.70. So the department's requesting reimbursement for that so that we can continue to pay these kinds of claims for next year.
Thank you, Ms. Jean Whitney. Are there any comments or questions? Representative Salk.
Mr. Chair, I'd just move that we go ahead and recognize these and pay them.
Representative Salk moves that we recognize the claims that were presented by Ms. Whitney. Are there any comments or questions to the motion? We will proceed to vote. All those in favor of the motion to pay the claims to the Department of Corrections signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. The motion is adopted, and the claims will be paid to the Department of Corrections. Ms. Whitney, you might want to just stay right where you're at because we've got some more coming in front of you. So the next item on the agenda are claims against the Department of Corrections. And these are injury, these are injury claims, I'm sorry, and property claims. So if you go ahead and give us some more information, that would be appreciative. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, do you want me to explain the claims or do you want
Mr. Keenly?
Mr. Keenly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can run through these and sort of give the synopsis that I had done and my recommendation. And
okay.
It provides a quicker summary than the Department of Corrections summary on most of these. So I'll start with the Clark claim. Claimant Clark asked for compensation for an injury from a dog bite. Claimant was participating in a dog training program when the noise from a lawnmower spooked a dog that bit claimant on the nose. Claimant was taken to the hospital and 6 stitches were used to close the wound. 2 months after the incident, claimant had a fine quarter-inch scar. Scars less than 2 centimeters, approximately 1 inch, are not compensable under the workers' compensation schedule, which is what the subcommittee has typically used for awarding injury claims. In this claim, the evidence was insufficient that there was an injury generating a partial permanent disability rating, and hearing and denial is recommended.
Thank you, Mr. Keenly. Is there any comments or questions to the Edward Clark claim? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did we want to make motions on these individually or go through them, discuss them, and then at the end of the 9 claims, I'll make a motion.
We can probably go through the 9 claims and make a motion at the end.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Keenly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next claimant is the Gluey claim. Claimant Glouy asked for compensation for an eye injury. While performing assigned welding duties, a metal shaving entered claimant's eye. Claimant was taken to the hospital but then sent to an eye clinic. The shaving was removed. The claimant's eye has minor scarring of the retina, but his corrected vision is 20/20 in each eye. Claimant continues to complain of redness and mild irritation. And while reviewing this afternoon, I also noted that in the medical records, he said that this was not the first time that this had happened. So it's unclear if the minor scarring is just due to this eye injury or if it may have been connected to previous injuries. But in either case, I found insufficient evidence of the injury generating a partial permanent disability rating because the claimant's vision is 20/20.
Any comments? Mr. Keenly, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next claim is the Gordon claim. This is actually a holdover from last year. Claimant Gordon asked for $7,000 for burns to his right foot and left wrist. The claim was held over last year to allow more time for his injuries to heal and determine if the injuries would result in hypersensation or lack of sensation. On reevaluation this year, medical records show claimant has mild sensitivity to touch and occasional discomfort to long-term pressure. However, neither are severe enough to be rated under the workers' compensation schedule. Again, there's insufficient evidence of an injury generating a partial permanent disability rating.
Members, any comments? Senator Rell.
Just one, Mr. Chair. It looks like, was this held over from a year ago?
Yes.
All right.
Mr. Keenly, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next claimant is claimant Henry, who asked for compensation for injuries due to ductwork falling on him. The claimant was working assigned duties when an HVAC ductwork fell on him. Claimant lost consciousness and injured his hand, neck, upper back, and right ankle. CT scans and x-rays came back normal. Claimant had tenderness for several weeks, then did not show up for appointments for about a month. At an appointment 2.5 months after the incident, most injury issues had been resolved. At an appointment 5 months after the injury, claimant only complained of issues that predated the work incident. Again, there's insufficient evidence that the injury generated a partial permanent disability rating.
Members, are there any comments? If not, please proceed, Mr. Keenly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next claim in your packet is the one that I mentioned for holding over, just the O'Reilly claim that the department is attempting to reach claimant O'Reilly, and we talked about that earlier when we were holding over claims. The next claim is the Ritchie claim. Claimant Ritchie asked for $200,000 for a severed little finger. Claimant was performing assigned duties. While using a drill press, his left glove was snagged and the tip of his left little finger was amputated. Claimant was transported to the hospital where he was treated. X-rays and medical records show claimant lost about one half of the distal tip of his left finger. The workers' compensation schedule splits at amputations for more than one half or less than one half. The Department of Corrections recommended the less than one half option, which calculates to $750. To me, it's not a very clear x-ray, but the x-ray appears to show that likely just over one half of the bone was severed. This would equate to a payment of $1,875.
Members, comments? Senator Rowe.
Just to clarify, so your examination of the x-ray shows that it looks like it was that the higher figure should be used. Do I understand that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ralph, like I said, the x-ray is relatively unclear, but given what's there, to me, like I said, it looks slightly more than one half of the finger, the bone there was amputated. So I would recommend the higher amount, but it's certainly up to the subcommittee to, I think both, either one would be a reasonable interpretation of the medical information in front of us.
Thank you.
I think maybe we'll take the last one, the O'Reilly one that we had just before, which is going to be laid over, and then maybe take the Ritchie one out just so we can debate that or talk about it. So maybe take the Ritchie one out of your folder so we can put it on our agenda after we make the final motion. Mr. Keeling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next claim is the Taylor claim. Claimant Taylor asked for compensation for a scalp scar. In 2014, claimant was performing assigned duties when he was assaulted. Officers responded and put claimant and others in restraints. While claimant was being escorted, another offender approached and punched him. The other offender was also restrained. Claimant was treated for several small cuts, all less than a half an inch. The cuts were treated. Claimant complains of an irritated scalp in the location of one of the cuts. Claimant has been diagnosed with, and this is going to test my medical ability to fumble through these words, lymphocytic cicatricial alopecia.
That.
Good work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This condition results in hair loss and scarring. The pictures from the time of the incident showed that the hair loss in the area had already begun. Claimant's injury was not sustained as part of his work, even though he was working at the time. Claimant could file against the offenders who attacked him in conciliation court. There's insufficient evidence of an injury generating a partial permanent disability rating.
Members, comments? If not, Mr. Keeling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next claim is claimant Vance Bryan, who asked for $5,000 for scars on his left leg caused by burns. Claimant was performing assigned duties in the kitchen facility. Claimant tripped and fell, spilling hot fryer oil on his leg. Claimant had about 10 small first-degree burns down his leg. Claimant was treated at the facility medical unit. Claimant returned twice a day for the following 4 days for checkup and to have bandages replaced. The medical notes on the final visit concluded that the burn was healing well. After that, there is nothing in the medical record regarding the burn. The area of the burn, when combined, would not constitute the required 5% body area to qualify for compensation under scarring. There's insufficient evidence of an injury generating a partial permanent disability rating.
Any comments or questions for Ms. Whitney on this particular claim? Mr. Keeling, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the last of the injury claims. Claimant Wolbeck asked for $2,000 for cost of repairing two chipped teeth. Claimant states he chipped a tooth while carrying boxes in December of 2017. Claimant was placed on the dental waiting list but was released before having the chipped teeth repaired. Prior dental records show at least one tooth was already chipped when claimant was incarcerated. Chipped teeth are not on the workers' compensation schedule. There's insufficient evidence of an injury generating a partial permanent disability rating.
Thank you, Mr. Keenley. Any comments by the members on these claims? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is that and I agree with the chair, that number 5 and 6 should be get additional discussion. I would move that 1 through 4 and 7 through 9, we accept the recommendation of staff and would deny those.
Are there any questions or comments to that motion? The motion before us, Representative Quam, moves that the injury claims being brought forward by the Department of Corrections, that we deny numbers 1 through 4 on the injury claim list and numbers 7, 8, and 9, and we hold out number 5 and 6 to be further talked about. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion has passed. We now have Mr. O'Reilly, which is a bill that's being laid over because of insufficient information regarding his claims. Ms. Whitney, can you give us any further insight on Mr. O'Reilly?
Mr. Chair, I can tell you that Mr. O'Reilly has been released from our custody, and we sent two letters to him at two different addresses. Both were returned to us. So we're kind of at a loss now about where to look, although I learned recently about a resource that we have through an account with Thomson Reuters that allows us to search for people's names and maybe find addresses. So if you'd like, I'd be happy to do that and try one more time to send a letter letting him know that if he'd like to get a final evaluation on his injury, he could have his claim heard next year.
Senator Ralph.
I would move we lay this over for another opportunity for the claimant to be found, and if not, I think that the next hearing we probably should consider the possibility of dismissing it.
Senator Ralph, Senator Representative Murphy.
How long has he been gone?
Ms. Whitney?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I believe he was released in January, but I could be wrong.
January of this
year? Of this year.
Representative Salk.
I actually think it might be reasonable if you do have one, another service that you could engage to do a search that connected with the final re-return, if you will, or whenever it comes back to our agenda, that would then be sufficient in my mind. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, unless that there's an exorbitant cost with this search, I guess that may not be completely necessary.
Mr. Keenly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for members' information, what's in the packet is that he was released September 27th, 2018.
Okay. September 27th, 2018?
So 6 months ago.
Okay. Well, Ms. Whitney, I will look forward to what you can find out for us, and I think we'll, even though it might seem like it's a longer time than we expected, the motion is on before us that we lay this particular claim over until our next claims committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. The motion is adopted and the O'Reilly claim is held over for the next claims committee. Our next injury claim is Mr. Ricky Ritchie. Ms. Whitney, can you give us some further insight on Mr. Ritchie?
Mr. Chair, I discussed this with Mr. Keenly, and I would be happy to change our recommendation to the over half of the distal left finger. I guess I'm not good at measurements or guessing, so I'm happy to go with that larger amount.
Ms. Whitney is making a recommendation or willing to concede to what Mr. Keenly has given us as evidence. Any further questions or comments? Mr. Representative Salk.
I would move that we pay the $18.75
okay.
as compensation for
any further comments to that motion. Mr. Senator, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is that if we pass this, that the dollars actually do come from the department. Is that correct?
Ms. Whitney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, no, the amount goes into the appropriation bill from this committee on these claims.
Right. Yeah. Mr. Keeling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam, you're correct on the property claims. The property claims are paid by the Department of Corrections themselves, but the injury claims we pay as an appropriation.
Any further comments on the motion to pay the higher amount of $18.75 for the Ricky Ritchie injury claim? If not, all those in favor of paying the Ricky Ritchie claim, the $18.75, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion is adopted. Mr. Keenly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you like to start with number one?
Yes. We're on the property claims, so we're on the back page. We're on the downhill slope. Maybe we'll get some sleep tonight. Wait.
The summary that I had written was that the claimant asked for $16.37 for a broken lamp. Claimant was transported to the hospital for a medical emergency. His property was inventoried. His lamp was marked as present and working. Claimant signed for his property. Claimant then came back and stated he unwrapped the cord of his lamp and found the clip broken. Ms. Whitney and I actually had a fair amount of back and forth regarding this claim ahead of the committee hearing, so I'm not surprised to see it resurface.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ralph.
I'm sorry. I'm looking at Manuel Guzman, and it says he that he lost a razor, not a lamp.
Oh.
Mr. Keeley?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ralph, we jumped to one of the ones that Senator Anderson had asked to be heard out. Number one on the list was one of the ones that Senator Anderson had asked to pull from the binder of things that I had recommended denial.
I'm sorry, so, I'm looking at Manuel Guzman. Is that the one we're looking at?
No.
I'm sorry.
We're on claim number one, which would be in your other binder, the first.
Forgive me, I was confused.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Am I right in understanding that the ones marked in red are in the back of the first binder, and that the other three, 1, 35, and 36, are actually in the larger binder that we haven't been previewing?
Mr. Keeley?
Mr. Chair, yes. Representative Quam, that's correct.
Well, the reason I brought this out is I went through all of these today and looked at, they have the OID number on the front page, but when you go back to the letter that it doesn't, and most of all of the claims except for this one doesn't have the OID number behind the claimant's name. And I'm just curious as to, was there an oversight? Was there something else that was missed? I see was it Mr. Felagy's claim that he didn't have an OID number? But just asking Ms. Whitney if there was an oversight and forgot to put the number in or what the reason was for it. Not that I was wanting to make sure this claim got passed. I'm just kind of, I'm being processual in my thinking here.
Mr. Chair, you have a good eye and you found a similar problem last year. And you're exactly right that normally the offender's OID is on there. I am guessing that on this one it's because he has a hyphenated last name and a long first name and there wasn't room in the box, but I don't know because I didn't type it myself.
Okay. I'm just looking at process, that's all.
I agree.
I would entertain a motion, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my house copy actually has the number, but it's not in color. But I would move that we accept the recommendation and deny the claim.
Motion by Representative Quam to deny the, Ayala Enriquez claim. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. The Ayala Enriquez claim is denied. Mr. Keenley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next one is the first one of the to be heard list, which is the Manuel Guzman. This is the one that you caught the similar error on, Chair Anderson, last year of a couple of names. After the hearing last year, Ms. Whitney provided some further information as to what happened that night. It seems that there were multiple offenders that were sent to segregation that night, one of them being Manuel Guzman, the other one being Miguel Garza, and there seems to have been some overlap of the information between those two. The Miguel Garza claim did not involve a razor, so I think everything having to do with a razor, probably documentation-wise, belongs to in this claim for claimant Guzman, but I think Ms. Whitney could speak more if she has more information.
Mr. Keeley and Ms. Whitney, my concern about this is that on page 4, that we have a Miguel Guzman that's been put in that. And that was what I had last year. My concern was, why was that? Is that still an error on the part of the department of putting that, having that name in there, and with a different OID number? That's what's really troubling to me, is that you've got a different OID number on page 4 and versus what his OID number is on the claimant's front page that Mr. Keenley just read off about him. And maybe you can explain.
Mr. Chair, as Mr. Keenley said, after the hearing last year, I went back and contacted the claims coordinator at Rush City. He was explaining to me that there were two men taken from the same living unit to the segregation unit. One was Guzman, one was Garza. And what happened is he sent me the wrong forms, and I gave them to you last year. He verified after I talked to him that it was Mr. Guzman who had the rotary razor. So everything else that we had was correct in terms of what staff did with the razor, but we just submitted one report that had the wrong offender's name on it.
So, Ms. Whitney, is Miguel, is that should be a different, should that not be there? Should it be Manuel?
Yes.
Or Manuel?
Yes, Mr. Okay. Chair.
I'm being persnickety here.
You are, and it's good.
Representative Murphy.
On that same line, Mr. Chair, Ms. Whitney, does Mr. Guzman have a beard this year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I have not looked at his photo ID lately, but I could check on that and get back to you.
Let's check on that and see what's happened.
Members, can I have a motion on Mr. Guzman?
I'll move it denial.
Representative Murphy makes motion to deny the claim for Manuel Guzman. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion is passed. Manuel Guzman's claim has been denied. Mr. Keenly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next claim is the Hazelrig claim. It's number 23. This is also in the binder to be heard. Claimant Hazelrig asked for $252 for a lost television. Claimant was moved because he feared for his safety from one cell to another. This was immediately done upon his request. However, before his property could be moved, video footage showed other offenders fishing his TV out of his cell. The staff searched the cells of the offenders who had fished the TV out, but the TV was not recovered.
Ms. Whitney.
Mr. Chair, this is a hard claim for me.
It's a hard claim for me, too.
Mm-hmm. One of the concerns that people in facilities have is that it is offenders' responsibility to protect their property. And if we pay a claim to an offender whose property was stolen by other offenders, then all offenders who have stolen property will file claims. So the facility is very nervous about setting a precedent like that. What I can say is that the staff did everything they could as soon as they learned that the TV had been stolen. They did see on the video surveillance footage that two offenders had used some kind of a stick or something, we don't know what, to fish between the bars. One of the problems with our older facilities is that they have open bar cells. So it's hard to secure property because you can stick things through it. So they identified the offenders who did the fishing expedition. They disciplined them, but it turned out that they had already disposed of the TV and we couldn't find it. We couldn't search all the cells in the living unit to find out there's 200 cells in the living unit. And staff don't have the time to go searching for someone else's property. So I said I would make my best argument, and if you feel that it's something we should pay, we'll pay it. But we wanted it to be your decision, and we wanted to explain our case about why it's difficult to manage property at Stillwater, 1,600 offenders who live on tiers that are stacked four high, and there are three officers on duty at any time. And if you see something on the fourth tier, hard to get there before things all happen.
Senator Ralph.
Just one question. Did Mr. Hazelrig move the TV away, or did the corrections officers to try and secure it? It says they moved it away from the bars, which sounds like at least they were aware of the fact that something like this might occur before they could get there. Is that the case, that the corrections officers moved the TV?
Mr. Chair. Senator Ralph, that's exactly right. Any time someone is moved away from the unit and deprived of the ability to protect their property, as soon as is possible, the staff go up and push the property back. And that's what happened in this case. The cell was locked. They pushed it back. But I don't know how many of you have been on tours. You're always welcome, I hope you know. And the bunks are close to the cell. It's not more than probably 3 feet from the door. And the TVs sit on a shelf up on the bunks. So there's not really much you can do to put them somewhere else. So if somebody can fish in that much, they can get it.
Mm-hmm. Representative Murphy.
Are TVs purchased at $252? Is that the price of the TVs that they have to get?
Ms. Whitney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I think there are two sizes of TVs. I'm so familiar with TVs now that I think one is 237 and one might be 252. If he had a 15-inch, maybe that was the $252 version.
Further comments?
Tough claim.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It appears as if standard procedures were followed. This is a difficult area, and that I would be reluctant to set a avalanche started with a precedent, and therefore I would move to deny the claim.
Any comments? Representative Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess what I'm wondering here is back in the supporting documentation, the names of the people that supposedly fished this out are redacted. In cases like this, is there any kind of penalty that these people have to suffer?
Ms. Whitney?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, yes, the offenders who were caught or who were observed taking the TV out were disciplined. I can't remember exactly what the penalty was. Generally, it's some kind of loss of privileges or time in segregation. In terms of restitution, we can't order any restitution for another offender. We can order restitution if they damage state property. So we do that if they damage state property, but we're not authorized to order restitution for stealing someone else's.
Senator Carlson, follow-up. Senator Ralph.
I'm assuming that obviously that this, Mr. Hazelrig would have a civil claim against them. Is there any provision or that the staff can provide to assist him in that claim? And not that it might do any good, but at least it would give him the opportunity to try and recover that money or get restitution ordered by the court.
Ms. Whitney?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ralph, yes, he could file a claim in conciliation court. We generally try not to give legal advice about what someone could do, but we do have a program with the state law library that helps offenders find legal information so that they can pursue claims on their own. So we could certainly refer him to the law library at the facility and suggest that he might contact them about his options.
Representative Salk.
I guess I'm troubled by this also, and the part that weighs is that I don't believe an offender should contemplate that the state is a custodian, a perfect custodian of their property, as it would be. They more than anybody else probably can contemplate the risks of that custodial act. So I'm with Representative Quam that I'm quite comfortable in that we would just deny the claim.
Any other comments?
The qualm motion is before us is that to deny the Alex Hazelrig claim. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign.
Aye.
The motion prevails, and the Alex Hazelrig claim has been denied. Mr. Keenly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next claim in the packet is the James claim, and this is another one that I had mentioned at the beginning of the hearing to hold over. We're still waiting to try to figure out exactly what shoes and when he had various shoes. If you look through the paperwork on this, it seemed like the claimant had a lot of shoes and boots going in and out, and it's sort of unclear what shoes he had at the time of this segregation. And I've asked the Department of Corrections for more information, and they're still working on that at this point.
Ms. Whitney?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if I sent to Mr. Keenly one document that I was able to retrieve. I contacted the facility claims coordinator. They could not find any other documentation. A signed property receipt is what we were looking for. Usually when the offenders pick up their property, they sign that they got it. In this case, the inventory indicated that he had all the shoes that we had marked on the inventory form, but he hadn't signed that form when he picked it up. I was able to retrieve a report from our electronic system that shows several pairs of Nikes being shipped out, and I have that report. I'm happy to provide it. I did not bring copies for everyone, but it shows that on June 19th, there was a pair of Nikes. I don't know what Hyper Dunks are. I'm not really into shoes that much, but I have a document that shows he sent out shoes both in March and in June. So it is a lot of shoes to take care of.
Members, comments or motions? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and being familiar with the shoe commodity and in previous discussions, and that there are reasons why they do have limits. I would move to deny the claim.
Any comments to the motion?
If not, I am concerned where this large pile of missing shoes actually exists. In light of what we've seen up to now, it must be getting very large.
It's a shoe library.
Maybe.
Members, the qualm motion to deny the Ronell James claim is before us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. The motion to deny the Ronell James claim is passed. Mr. Keenly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next on the list numerically are the other two that you had asked to look at, number 35 and 36, which are in the other binder, the two William Linear claims. I can walk through those, or if you would like to talk about your concerns.
Yeah, it's in the big one. It's right in the middle of between
what was the name again?
K and R. The reason I'm concerned about that is they have an OID number. I'm back to this being persnickety again. They have one assigned to Mr. Linear on the first claim, and then he has a second claim, and the OID number for the second claim, it doesn't match with the name given on the page behind the front page. And the one behind it says it's 218129, and the one on the front is 251636. And I'm just wondering if Mr. Linear is a twin. Or he's I don't know. I just don't understand why the OID number can't be right.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm trying to
Whitney.
Find... Are you referring to...
Mr. Keenly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the form where the OID number is incorrect in this one is actually was staff error. The OID numbers within what the department submitted, I believe, are the same, but it's what we put on the cover sheet that was incorrect.
So the correct number is the one submitted by the Department of Corrections. The one that was submitted for the claims committee is wrong.
Mr. Chair, the 218129 number is the correct
That's
number.
That's the correct
for him.
Number.
So the one on
from
the
Department of Corrections.
For the Department of Corrections. So the first lien year claim, the cover sheet that staff put on it, has that correct number. The second one has a different OID number, which probably corresponds with something that came in at the same time.
Thank you. And I will make a motion that we deny the two claims for Mr. William Linear with two different, I guess they're both the same.
Correct.
But I make the motion to deny both those claims. Any comments or questions to that? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion is passed, and we've denied both the claims for William Linear. Mr. Keenly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I believe this is the last claim of the night, unless anyone else wants to continue hearing claims.
I know.
The last claim is the Waheed claim. Claimant Waheed asked for $2,037.50 for lost documents. Claimant packaged up copies of kites and medical records to be shipped to his family. A month later, the package had not been shipped. Claimant began investigating the lack of the shipment and began reordering the copies that he had made. 2 weeks later, the original package was found and shipped. Claimant then stated that items were missing when it arrived, including items that were not on the property disposition form that he filled out when he sent out the package. Claimant provided only a list of the documents he states should have been in the package, but has not provided any detail of which documents were missing. The Department of Corrections offered $20 for the costs of the copies that he made while the location of the package was unknown, and the claimant rejected that offer. There's insufficient evidence that a loss occurred. However, the department action did lead to the unnecessary expense of the $20 that he copied. My recommendation is to hear this and reoffer the $20.
Ms. Whitney?
Mr. Chair, I concur with Mr. Keenly. We did the best we could. I contacted the claims coordinator at Moose Lake. He said there was no way to know what documents were in there. Given the weight of the package, he thought at 25, I think it's 25 cents a copy, that $20 would give him he could copy whatever documents he needed. That was the best offer we could come up with, and we're happy to renew that if that's what the committee would like.
Could I up the bid to 28?
Mr. Chair, you could do that.
Members, any comments, sir?
Mr. Chair, what is a kite?
Ms. Whitney?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ralph, a kite is a form that has lines on it so offenders can write on it. They write a message to a staff person on the top of the form, and then there are lines on the second half for the staff person to respond to them. So if they want to communicate with someone who isn't in the living unit where they live, say someone in food service or someone in property, that's how they communicate because they can't, pick up their cell phone or walk down there. They have to communicate in writing. So, and it's kind of a, like your story with Mr., I forgot his name, Felici. It has a long history, and kites were pieces of paper that offenders would make into airplanes and sail into the cells. That's how they communicated with each other, and it's sort of stuck.
Senator Ralph, you got a follow-up?
No, just I'd like to see how they made those airplanes.
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Whitney.
I have one other thing that I wanted to point out to the committee, and you can take a claim off the list that you're going to deny. Because today I worked with the associate warden at Rush City to settle a claim with Mr. Christopher Cabrera. He's number 8 on the list that you have in, I don't know which binder, I bet the big binder. Mr. Cabrera had a TV stand that was broken, and I had asked, after Mr. Keenly asked me some questions, I had asked some more questions about it of the staff there, and what they determined is that they could repair the TV and give it back to him because one of the officers hadn't completed the reports properly, so we didn't have good documentation that the TV had been broken when the officers found it, so we agreed to repair it, and Mr. Cabrera agreed to accept that offer. So one down.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That sounds like a technical correction staff could make to the list with the updated information.
I think so. I believe so. Any other comments on the Waheed claim before us?
I don't have any other comments.
I would move that we reoffer the $20.
Any comments to that? Don't want to take my $28? The motion before us right now, Senator Ralph moves that we reoffer the $20 amount to Mr. Waheed regarding his claim. And all those in favor signify by saying aye. All those opposed, same sign. The motion passes, and the claim is going to be paid with $20 to the Aleem Waheed claimant. So, members, are there any other comments or questions that you have for the claims committee? Mr. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I would like to thank Ms. Whitney and our counsel for their work and their back and forth work and their dedication to service. And, Mr. Chairman, is this one, do you hire somebody to go through those and check those numbers?
I hire my brain. Mr. Keeley?
Good job, everyone.
Mr. Chair, I also wanted to thank someone. Matt Frame, who's over there, is our extern within our office this year and did a lot of the initial work on the Department of Corrections property claims to figure out what information might be helpful for me to ask to Ms. Whitney in order to resolve a number of claims before they even got here and make this as clear of a process as possible.
Thank you, Mr. Keenly. I, too, would like to thank Ms. Whitney and these others in our staff here for being a part of the claims committee. I know it's a joy for us to sit down and read these claims. Oh, everybody's laughing.
Or not.
But I do thank you for being in attendance, and I thank you for the opportunity to at least take these, because these people have really taken it seriously, because there's people out there who are constituents who feel that the state has unjustly been against them in some fashion, form. So thank you for all your work. Thank you for being a part of this. And with that, I will adjourn the Joint House and Senate Subcommittee on Claims, and we will let you know when the next meeting will be coming up. Thank you, members.